The fluorescent lights in the 4th floor break room didn't just illuminate the space, they vibrated, a low-frequency hum that seemed to sync perfectly with the frantic pulse in my throat. Mark was standing too close. The scent of his expensive, woodsy cologne mixing with the stale smell of over-roasted Arabica. He wasn't looking at the coffee machine. He was looking at the way my silk blouse caught the light, his eyes tracing a path that felt like a physical touch. He told me that my presentation in the morning meeting was the only reason the stakeholders stayed awake, his voice dropping an octave, honey-thick and dangerously private. I felt the heat rise from my chest to my cheeks, that familiar, reckless spark of being seen by the one person who mattered in this sterile, gray-carpeted ecosystem. I smiled. A small, tentative admission of the tension that had been building between us for 6 months of late-night Slack messages and lingering glances over dual monitors. I told him he was biased. My voice breathy, a playful challenge that I realized too late was actually a surrender. For months, Mark had been the architect of this specific atmosphere. He was the one who would find reasons to brush past my desk, his hand lingering on the back of my chair just a second too long. He was the one who sent the midnight messages that started as project updates and devolved into intimate confessions about his failed marriage and the crushing loneliness of his glass-walled corner office. He made me feel like an island of competence and beauty in a sea of corporate mediocrity. He fed me the attention I didn't know I was starving for until I was hooked. Until I was looking for his car in the parking lot every morning like a compass pointing north. The flirtation was a slow-motion car crash I couldn't look away from. A high-stakes game where he held all the cards and I was just happy to be at the table. But the shift happened, the moment I leaned in. It was a Friday evening, the office nearly empty. The cleaning crew's vacuum humming in the distance like a warning siren. We were looking at the Q3 projections, our shoulders touching, the air between us thick enough to choke on. He made a comment about how much he admired my ambition, how rare it was to find someone who understood the sacrifice it took to get to his level. I looked at him, really looked at him, and told him that maybe the sacrifice didn't have to be so lonely. I reached out, my fingers grazing his forearm, a silent confirmation that the subtext was finally becoming text. I expected him to pull me closer. I expected the payoff to the months of excruciating buildup. Instead, I watched his face transform. The warmth vanished, replaced by a cold, clinical detachment that made my blood turn to ice. He looked at my hand on his arm as if it were a parasitic growth he needed to excise. He stood up abruptly, the chair screeching against the linoleum, and told me that he had a hard stop for a dinner meeting he'd forgotten to mention. His voice was stripped of all the honey, replaced by a jagged professional edge that made my heart drop into my stomach. He didn't look back as he walked out, leaving me standing in the dim light of the conference room, my hand still hanging in the air, grasping at nothing. The punishment began on Monday morning. It wasn't loud or obvious. It was a surgical, systematic dismantling of my professional standing. In the weekly stand-up, Mark didn't look at me. When I brought up the progress on the Thompson account, the very project he had praised me for 72 hours earlier, he cut me off mid-sentence. He told the entire room that my approach was lacking rigor, his tone dismissive, as if he were correcting a clumsy intern rather than his top-performing senior analyst. I felt 20 pairs of eyes swivel toward me, the air in the room suddenly too thin to breathe. I tried to defend the data, citing the metrics we had reviewed together over drinks just last week, but he laughed, a short barking sound that didn't reach his eyes. He told me that perhaps I was letting my personal feelings cloud my professional judgment, the double entendre hitting me like a physical blow. He began to move the goalposts daily. Tasks that were once my responsibility were quietly reassigned to Sarah, the new hire who still didn't know how to use the CRM. Meetings I had chaired for a year were suddenly streamlined to exclude me. When I went to his office to ask for clarity, he wouldn't even look up from his screen. He told me he was too busy for emotional debriefs, and that if I couldn't handle the pressure of the department, I should perhaps reconsider my long-term goals. The man who had texted me about his deepest fears at 2 a.m. was gone, replaced by a tyrant who seemed disgusted by my very existence. I realized then that Mark didn't want a partner or even a mistress. He wanted a devotee. He needed the pursuit, the thrill of seeing a capable, independent woman crumble under the weight of his manufactured charm. But the moment the prey was caught, the moment I showed him that his tactics had worked, I became a mirror reflecting his own predatory nature back at him. And he hated what he saw. He couldn't stand the fact that I had actually believed the lies he told to get what he wanted. To him, my desire was a weakness, a flaw that proved I wasn't worthy of the position I held. He had seduced me just to prove he could, and now he was destroying me to prove that it meant nothing to him. The gaslighting was the hardest part to swallow. He started BCCing HR on mundane emails, framing my confusion as incompetence. He would give me verbal instructions and then deny they ever happened when the deadline arrived, leaving no paper trail but his own fabricated narrative of my declining performance. I would sit at my desk, staring at the screen until the text blurred into a gray smear, wondering if I had imagined the last 6 months. Maybe he never touched my hand. Maybe he never told me I was the only thing keeping him sane. But then I would see him in the break room with someone else, leaning in, his voice dropping into that familiar honeyed register. And I knew the cycle was simply beginning again with a new target. I felt like I was walking through a minefield every time I stepped off the elevator. Every Slack notification made my stomach flip. A Pavlovian response to the digital lashings he handed out with terrifying precision. I stopped eating. I stopped sleeping. My apartment, once a sanctuary, felt like a waiting room for the next disaster. I would rehearse conversations in the shower, trying to find the magic combination of words that would return us to the status quo, only to realize there was no status quo to return to. The man I thought I knew was a fiction, a skin he wore to lure in the gullible. The breaking point came during the annual performance review. I walked into his office, my posture rigid, my spine a steel rod of suppressed fury. He sat behind his mahogany desk, looking every bit the corporate kingling, and handed me a 3-page document detailing my failure to integrate with the team culture. He spoke about my erratic behavior and unprofessional boundaries, his voice calm and terrifyingly reasonable. I looked at the paper, then at him, and I felt something snap inside me. The fear was gone, replaced by a cold, crystalline clarity. I told him that it was fascinating how my performance only became an issue once I stopped being a receptive audience for his midlife crisis. He didn't flinch. He leaned back in his chair, a small, cruel smile playing at the corners of his mouth. He told me that no one would believe me. He reminded me that he had been with the firm for 15 years, that his father sat on the board, and that I was just another ambitious girl who got confused by a little bit of professional mentorship. He suggested that if I wanted to keep my severance package, I should sign the NDA and walk out quietly. He looked at me with such profound loathing that I finally understood the depth of the trap. He hadn't just wanted to break my heart. He wanted to erase my career. I stood up, leaving the unsigned papers on his desk. I walked out of the glass doors, the sunlight of the atrium blindingly bright after the shadows of his office. I didn't take my desk plant or my extra pair of shoes. I just walked until the hum of the fluorescent lights was a distant memory. I knew the fight was far from over, that he had the power and the connections to make my next move nearly impossible. But as I reached the street, the cold air hitting my face, I realized that the worst part wasn't losing the job. It was the realization that he was still in there, waiting for the next woman to walk into the break room, waiting for the next chance to prove that he could make someone love him, and then make them regret it for the rest of their life.